This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hello, my friend. Welcome back to another episode of Creator Science. We have a fun new episode here for you today. I'm speaking with my friend, Kieran Drew. Kieran has a newsletter called Digital Freedom with nearly 30,000 subscribers. He also has more than 175,000 followers on Twitter, which is potentially where you have heard of Kieran. Kieran is an ex-dentist who quit dentistry to learn writing, and now that is what he is teaching others as well. And recently, Kieran launched a new course called High Impact Writing. I had a front row seat to that course launch on Twitter and from his newsletter, and boy, oh boy, did it go well. I will let him tell you just how well that course launch went.
The launch was 4 days long. There are 500 students, give or take maybe like three or four people. And we made $142,000. I can't remember the exact to the dollar, but it was around there.
4 days, 500 students, $142,000 at the launch of that course. Now, to be honest with you, I've never had a launch anywhere near that successful. And so I wanted to learn from Kieran just as much as I wanted to share with you what he learned in this process. So in this episode, we are getting into the weeds. We are talking all about the process for creating and launching this course. We talk about what he would do differently if he were to do it again, and all of the other lessons that he learned in launching High Impact Writing. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. As you listen, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at jklaus. I'm getting more active on Instagram, so find me over there if you haven't already. Just tag me, say hello, let me know that you're listening. And now let's talk with Kieran.
In terms of the price point, we launched the main course at $297. A couple of days before, we added tiered pricing. I'm a huge fan of Nathan Barry. I know you are too. And I just remember him saying it a while ago, and I was like, fuck, you're missing something here. So I added that on, which was $1,000. And what that was just the course and a call with me. That grossed maybe an extra $10,000. And then what we did was, I released my first product a year ago, 12 months before this one. So that was an upsell, you know, one click offer sort of thing. And that grossed maybe another 8,000 or so. So, you know, small touches around it, but kind of adds up over time. Yeah. So retail price was 250. And so the upsell was basically, you know, this is a one-time offer. You can get it for whatever, 63% off, which was around $98, I think.
I'm already loving this so much because people don't talk about this. And I love geeking out about numbers. I love this type of thing, like really breaking down exactly what's going on here. We do this type of thing in the lab all the time, but it's fun to do this in a public forum. So this is the second product launch. How would you compare it to your experience with that first product launch, the original $250 course?
How would I compare it? I mean, it's like... It's kind of like going to like a kid's soccer game for number one versus like a proper professional match. It was absolutely wild. I mean, the first product was, I had no clue what I was doing. And I mean, I still have no clue what I'm doing, but a little bit further along that cluelessness. But I mean, the first one was $5,000 in 5 days. And yeah, just this one was completely unexpected in terms of how it went, particularly on the last day, which was, I think it was like $75,000 on the final day alone.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, mate, like I'll tell you a quick story. So I try not to get my hopes up about these things, but I'd started speaking to entrepreneurs who were like, you know, Twitter creators, they should be getting six-figure launches. And I was aiming for $30,000 this time around. And so it's people like Grammar Hippie. And I kind of got my hopes up a little bit, which is like my rule number one for creating. And anyway, so when I click launch, you know, send that email the second time round, I was like, don't get your hopes up, but you know, we're going to go to the pub in 2 hours, me and my girlfriend, and celebrate this influx of sales. And I think we made 8 sales in the first 2.5 hours. And I could just watch, and man, I worked pretty hard for this one. I could just watch 3 months of effort. Like, I was like, something is seriously wrong in my funnel somewhere. Like maybe I got like a spelling mistake at the start of the copy. But I think this social proof flywheel really started to kick in around day two, day three. And so the final day, man, when I woke up the final 2 hours of the launch, mind blown.
And for context for folks, you're saying Twitter creators, you have about 168,000 followers on Twitter at the time of writing this. Email list is how big?
22,000.
So yeah. Significant on both fronts. Do you have any idea, like attribution percentage that came from email versus Twitter?
You're going to hate me, man. I don't. I wish I could. Yeah, like I'm sure there is a way to do it. But usually my rule is that I just don't sell on Twitter so that I know precisely what's going on for email and I can just treat it as top of funnel. But flagship product, I thought this time, let's just build hype around it on social. And so I can't actually track what it is.
You've been using the word we a lot. As in, we did this. We did a 4-day course this time. Is there an actual we, or are you just using the royal we to refer to like the company?
Well, I'm British, so it's the royal we. I'm really good at it. Me and my girlfriend. So my girlfriend actually, she became a partner in the business in January. So she quit her 9-to-5 because like it was just crazy busy. And so she handled all the design stuff, very helpful in like operations because my organization skills are awful. It was a very, very big joint effort this time around, which is brilliant.
How long did you prep for this? Like, I want to talk about what led up to the launch. You know, you said the launch was 4 days. I want to get a sense for what led up to that 4-day period that allowed those 4 days to be such a success.
I'm not a launch expert at all. Obviously, it's the second launch I've done, but it did go really well. And I think the thing that helped the most, mate, was it wasn't, you know, the 2 weeks before, but maybe even the entire year before. Because one thing that I had prioritized with my brand is that I have been trying to over-deliver at every opportunity. So we've created 8 free video courses. And I feel like that free content almost proved our credibility in terms of, you know, this guy's worth investing in because people only buy, right, when they have a problem to solve and when they trust you. And so I feel like that trust was the long game. We built quite a nice brand over time. In terms of the actual product, so I started advertising it in January. So it's about 4 or 5 months before. I hadn't built it. I didn't know the name. I'm just a very big fan of public accountability to start talking about something to make it happen. But what happened, Jane, I think you actually wrote about this, about consistency being a gift and a curse, right? I have very rarely not posted 2 threads a week in my newsletter. And what happened, mate, was like after about 2 months, high impact writing, still didn't have a name, still hadn't been written. And so around February, May time, March time, it was all in. So I stopped writing Twitter content. I just repurposed old stuff. I actually stopped my whole newsletter. And that was terrifying, man, because that was the first time I tried to make like an asymmetrical bet as opposed to that like consistent grind fest. So the real work probably started about three to 1 month prior.
And that looked like actually writing the course, filming the course.
Yeah. So in terms of building the course, I originally wrote it straight onto slides, as in, you know, this is how it's going to look. And it just came out so waffly. Like it just wasn't concise enough. Yeah. I tried to skip that writing stage, which is so stupid for me because, you know, writing is the core of everything. So I had to throw it away. I ended up rewriting it maybe like 3-4 times. And by the end of it, mate, you know, I wrote it on computer, still too waffly. I thought, you know what? Let's write it out by hand because that really forces you to be concise.
Wow.
Then we turned it into slides, which my girlfriend did because she's great at designing. Because what I was trying to do, man, was have this like aha moment every 5-10 minutes. And quite a lot of that is the delivery, you know, these like, I call them sexy final sentences, which you can just really summarize your points. So the writing bit was probably the bulk of it. And then there was the whole marketing around it afterwards.
Yeah, I've gotten in this flow now where if I'm creating something that's going to live on slides, my flow is I basically write it out in bullet point format in a page. And this is true for presentations. It's also true for the courses I make. Like for courses, I go into Notion, I make a table database, and then I start just like dropping all the ideas I have in terms of like learning objectives or questions. Sometimes they're kind of one and the same. So like for the community building course I had, it's like launching with email, launching with Twitter, pricing your membership. And then I'll order those things. And then each of those line items in the Notion database can be opened up into a page. And that's where I do like the bullet point structure. Those become slides and that becomes recorded. there's a lot of steps in there. Like the actual like writing and formatting of courses. And I learned a ton from LinkedIn when I worked with them at LinkedIn Learning. They acquired lynda.com a few years ago. That's what LinkedIn Learning, yeah, where it came from. And I learned a ton about them in terms of structuring learning content around learning objectives for each video. They were very strict. Like every video lesson should have its own discrete learning objective that you can phrase as, by the end of this video, the course that the student will be able to, and then it's like verb. There's like this thing called Bloom's Taxonomy Verbs. And it's stuff that's like six different columns: knowledge, understand, apply, analyze, evaluate, create. And they said you should be able to pick one word from each of these columns. By the end of this lesson, the student should be able to solve this type of problem, or relate this type of thing to this type of thing, or defend this type of thing. So it's really interesting how deep you can go on learning objectives. How did you think about that in what became a lesson versus a module? How did you go about structure?
Yeah, I mean, I think I might have heard you talk about this before. So there was back in my head that every lesson has to have the student gets this benefit from the thing. And you kind of extrapolate that upwards, right? So it's per lesson, per module, per course. The thing that I struggled with a lot was what stays in and what goes out. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote the final draft, I actually ended up deleting maybe another 30-40%. And that was quite brutal, but it was like, it's all actually just bonuses now, right? Or it's coming like unexpected bonuses, stuff I wanted to put in. But for the most part, mate, I thought about, so for each lesson, it either had to dispel a big myth or hit home a firm belief of mine. So the big myth was always a great positioning, because it was always like, most people tell you to write platitudes to grow. But actually, if you look at my story tweet format, storytelling will get 5 times the amount of impression to profile visit ratio. So here's how you write a story tweet. And then we dive into it. And the feedback has been brilliant on that side of things, where people are like, I feel like you're opening my eyes on stuff. But I do have a little bone to pick with you, mate, because one thing I love about you is your commitment to quality. I mean, it really shines through. And my first product was just scrappy, put together, no planning, all this sort of stuff. And so this time around, obviously a lot of work going into it. And I sent you a message about 6 weeks before being like, hey man, you sound great. Like what mic are you using? So you sent me the mic. And what I didn't realize about these mics are that they have to be quite close to your mouth.
Oh yeah.
And so yeah. I've filmed 64 lessons and audio is too quiet.
Yeah, but you can boost that. You can fix that.
It's all getting sorted now for the relaunch. But I was just like, I got one email, and then, you know, one of my favorite rules about the internet is like, if one customer is saying it, 10 customers are thinking it. And I don't know why I didn't just listen to it myself on like video 3. So thank you for that, mate. But I do sound nice. I just need to crank it up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, also like hire an audio engineer. People ask me all the time, like, what microphone do you use? It sounds so good on the podcast. I'm like, well, I'll tell you the microphone. It's a Rode Podcaster USB microphone, which you have right here, which I didn't even know they still made. It's great because of the audio profile that comes through. But what people don't realize is this audio is also mixed by an audio engineer who's fantastic. Like, not only does the microphone give good raw material, he makes it really, really great. And an audio engineer could take that and make it louder. It'd be easy for them to do.
Thankfully, one of my customers is an audio engineer, so he's very kindly volunteered to sort it all out for me.
After a quick break, Kieran and I dig into what he said a moment ago, which was, during the creation of his course, he stopped creating new social content and repurposed some of his old content. We're going to dig into just exactly how he did that right after this. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Last year, my wife and I started talking about her joining the business full time. This is a huge decision, not just for the business, but for our marriage. My wife, being the very smart and thoughtful woman that she is, suggested that we proactively sign up for therapy as a couple to help us communicate better before we started working together. It really helped us have better language to describe how we're feeling and listen to one another, which generally lowers the intensity of any conversation. Now, I had never been in therapy before, but here's something that I didn't expect. It didn't just help our dialogue, but it helped my inner monologue too. The way I understand my own experience has changed based on the tools that I got from therapy. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, it fits your schedule, and you can be in the comfort of your own home. Just fill out a short questionnaire and you'll get matched with a licensed therapist. They even make it easy to switch therapists if it doesn't feel like a fit. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/creator today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/creator. This episode is sponsored by Podcast Movement. For the past decade, Podcast Movement has organized the world's largest gathering of podcasters, featuring thousands of attendees, hundreds of breakout sessions, panels, and workshops, plus the largest trade show in podcasting. Podcast Movement helps podcasters of all experience levels create, grow, and profit from their show. It's suitable for beginners, but you'll also have the opportunity to meet some of the biggest names in the industry. I've been to several Podcast Movement events, and not only is the programming incredible, but the culture and vibe are incredible too. It attracts thoughtful, empathetic, and collaborative people, which makes sense when you think about the medium of podcasting. Podcast Movement hosts two events per year. The first just wrapped up, but their flagship conference is happening August 19th through the 22nd in Washington, D.C. Attendees have the freedom to choose their own adventure across several different stages throughout the four-day event, not to mention dozens of amazing networking events, parties, and the expo hall floor. Tracks include podcast creation, video and live streaming, industry professional, plus several stages of curated programming from some of the top companies in podcasting. It's truly a unique event, and if you are a podcaster, I cannot recommend it enough. Right now, tickets are available at super duper early bird pricing. And as a Creator Science listener, you can save $50 on top of that by visiting podcastmovement.com/science. That's podcastmovement.com/science. And now back to my conversation with Kieran Drew. You mentioned a second ago that when you're really in the trenches of building the course, writing the course, you didn't write on Twitter, you just repurposed things. Seems like people who get to a point where they want to focus on some bigger project, but they feel like, but I have some momentum. I don't want to lose momentum. I want to do this. So when you did that, talk to me about your process for repurposing your Twitter content for a couple of months. What did that look like?
So actually, on my Notion, I have something called a Hall of Fame. Basically, when a tweet hits a certain criteria, it gets imported into Notion. So I have this database of, you know, hundreds, probably about 1,000 tweets now. So the actual repurposing bit was pretty straightforward. I personally don't like to just repost stuff. And if I am going to do that, it has to be 6 months minimum. I know a lot of people say 3 to 4, but I can tell when someone is reposting their stuff every 2 to 3 months. And I do think that like reputation is something that you should prioritize. But what I will do, mate, is I'll take one tweet and I'll turn it into 10. Very, very similar. And then, you know, it's like a sniper than a shotgun, right? So you have one tweet that hits home and then you spread the effect. So done that, just I set aside maybe 5 hours and I just went through my Hall of Fame and I just turned it into loads more stuff. And then I took my threads and I just changed the hook. You know, different angle, storytelling angles. If it was already a storytelling angle, turn it into just a, you know, creator tips angle. Just stuff like that, man, because I'm very conscious that this whole content game becomes a bit of a trap, right? And there is actually a lot more that you should be doing with the leverage you build down the line. But if you're constantly in that carousel of content, you just can't do it. So I'm on a big push to try and make content as effortless as possible. Because at the end of the day, man, like the product only went so well because I put so much time into it. But by doing that, it's helped me kind of step up that next level. You know, I sort of clawed my way from like having no clue at all, some dentist and didn't even know what copyright existed. So it's kind of just, it just goes to show that sometimes it's better to step away, make content as effortless as possible so you can go big on something else that hopefully boosts your authority and reputation after.
For your Hall of Fame, is that an automation that runs through Zapier or something? Can you walk us through how that functions?
Yeah. So originally it was through Make, fully automated. So I didn't build this, by the way, a friend did. And when a tweet got to 300 likes, it would auto import. I do love data-driven growth, but like people can get way too into it, particularly for social. And to me, I just say, look, likes, it's not the perfect metric, but at least it's a good indicator of like people enjoying it. And it would just auto import every day, anything that got above 300. The problem is now that API change happened, it really screwed up that whole plan. So what we're doing now is Blackmagic emails a report, right? And I think you can download that report as a Excel file, and then the rest happens automatically. So I actually don't have that running at the moment. He's just building it for us now.
Yeah. Well, give me his email. I actually think that you can work around that Make thing by making your own personal Twitter app. I mean, I had a similar thing happen with like Tweet 100 was a project I did that's completely dead now because of this Twitter thing. I was doing a similar automation, but it was logging every tweet and tabulating the results of that tweet after 24 hours. And then I would rank by activity, but I also haven't solved the problem since it was broken. So when you did that 5-hour session, are you then scheduling those tweets in some other third-party software for a week at a time, a month at a time?
Yeah. I mean, I schedule in Hype Theory. So, I mean, at that time, I scheduled as far ahead as possible, which was a good couple months. And it was probably, maybe more like 6 to 8 hours when I went back to edit it the next day. But I'm always, mate, I'm a week to 2 weeks ahead of content. So everything is scheduled because I hate that feeling of pressure, right? If I ever have to sit down and think, oh God, I have to do something today, it kind of snaps me out of the flow of executing on the higher level of contribution. But also, man, I think it's a really cool writing trick, right? If you could just get a couple of weeks ahead, then on a Monday morning for 20 minutes, you know, a little bit hungover, maybe I just read my content for Hype Theory and I go.
You drink it on Sundays?
Man, I drink on a Friday and I'm hungover on a Monday, man. I'm like 30 going on 60. But that aside, that little buffer, just checking on a Monday when you read your content and you scheduled it, you know, 2 weeks before, you pick up on so many little tricks and, you know, like I can make that sound more elegant or articulate. So I'm a huge fan of this like content buffer, take the pressure off so you can think clearly and improve your quality.
Yeah, we just did a sprint in the community around this exact point because it also changes your relationship to the content. I find that if you're ahead, you have less pressure on publishing something. So I find that I'm more aware. I notice different things. The content is more fun and playful. It's coming from a positive energy place of I'm sharing this because I want to, not because I have a deadline. So big fan of getting ahead. It's hard, but if people are listening to this and finding it hard, I recommend just taking 2 weeks off. Do the same production you would, but just schedule it 2 weeks from now. And then suddenly some time passes and you're ahead of the curve.
Yeah. I mean, I just say tweet a day. You know, how long would that take you to write? Half an hour? Tweet a day, just step back for a bit because, again, consistency is a gift and a curse, right? Like, yes, you might not get as much engagement for a week or two, but it's so mentally relieving to just think, you know what, this content thing I can do on 2 days of the week and I've got 3 days of the week to actually build something with it. So, yeah, man, I love it. And congratulations, by the way, the community. I've heard you're doing very well now. So I saw your tweet about the revenue.
It's been transformative for the business, but I've never had a digital product launch like we're talking about here that you've had. You know, digital products are something that's what I want to build a business on. And historically, I haven't done a very good job of that. This is my highest month ever. We're recording this in the middle of June. Highest month ever of digital product sales. And it's still been a pretty concerted effort, I'll say. Like it hasn't come from just like, oh, I signed up to the Creator Science newsletter and I got introduced to a product and I purchased. Like it's been me intentionally plugging things in places and talking about it. But that's the grand experiment for the year is by the end of this year, on a monthly basis, I want more revenue to be coming from digital products than the membership without decreasing, you know, the top line of the membership.
Is that because the membership's been quite time intensive for you?
It's because I think that's what builds a more resilient business. And the style of business you and I are building, I think there should be a direct correlation between audience growth and revenue growth. Like if you grow the audience, it should enter the machine that is the Kieran Drew universe. And that input of new attention should lead to some percentage conversion to new sales. So that the whole game is the more people I get in front of, the more people find my work, they get results, they get an offer to a specific product, they purchase, and that's how the machine works. And right now, the machine doesn't work that way for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's not working too smooth for me either, but it's always a work in progress, right? I do remember saying 12 months ago, I would love a business where the more you write, the more you earn. And so it's just reach, relationships, revenue, right? And just trying to optimize those three things. So yeah, so again, we're on the same sort of path, I guess.
I want to talk a little bit about churn. Because something I hear from creators who are thinking about doing a launch model is they are afraid of turning people off, pissing them off, getting a bunch of churn. During this 4-day launch period, did you notice an impact of churn in subscribers or followers that was higher than normal?
A couple of interesting things, actually, mate. I was terrified to market my product the first time around. But I kind of believe now that you should only be scared of marketing too much if you haven't provided enough value in the first place. And so when I was doing the emails this time around, what I did was I started building a waiting list in like January. So by the time I actually came to launch, mate, we had 1,800 people on the waiting list alone. And so these people have raised their hands to say, yeah, I'm interested in high impact writing. They know they're being sold to, but people don't mind being sold to when you give them a reason, right? They've been expecting it. I made sure, so my rule for emails, man, is that before I sell, I have to teach. And before I teach, I have to tell a story. Because then at least that way, if you don't buy, you learn something and you get entertained. So each email was quite fun. And then what I did was for my marketing, so I actually wrote maybe, it was a lot, man. It was like 18 emails. But my whole list only got like 3. And then my engage list got maybe 10. And then the waiting list got all the rest. So I didn't actually get many complaints that, you know, people, you're sending me too many emails. At the end of the day, you speak to direct response people, right? And they're like, good. Let them go. They're not buyers. And I'm not sure I buy into that philosophy entirely because I do feel like people deserve the chance to become a buyer. And that might not be for 6 to 12 months. But there is that 4-day thing where it's like, well, look, if you're going to do it, you have to do it right here. In terms of email then, probably stayed about the same. So I didn't, which means that obviously we did churn for a little bit, but not like a massive hit. And I actually stopped growing my newsletter, but the Creator Network came through, which is brilliant. On Twitter though, man, I thought, because again, I hate selling on social media. I was like, this is going to be awful. But because I'm a big fan of this like building public approach. So, you know, it's like, oh shit, this isn't going well. And then, oh cool, this is going pretty well. And then the way that I set it up, man, was that when you buy the product, you get an email from me, you know, just saying thank you. It's got a picture of me, my little sign, which I do in every email. And I just say, look, I really appreciate you buying it. When you take this course, if you're enjoying the first module, would you mind just posting a screenshot on Twitter for me so I can get more exposure? And by the end of it, man, I was retweeting every 10 minutes, which is crazy. And long story short, I thought it would destroy my audience growth. It was probably my best week in months.
Really?
Yeah. And I think it's because people pay attention to someone doing something, right?
Yeah.
And of course, number flexes do well. But like when someone says a tweet like, oh, fuck, excuse my language, we sold X amount. I think that helped. But overall, man, like I think, I don't know if it's one of those beliefs where it's like, is it actually true? So long as it's not, I'm not being like pushy, like buy my stuff. Like I'm joking about it. I'm like, people buying this, got this email. Or like one of my emails was like, I got in a fight with Danko and Justin Welch. And like these things were just, it was like a nice way to market. So I don't think it made that much of a difference, man.
I want to talk about things that you think you did really well in this launch and then things that you would do differently if you were to start over again. Let's start with the things that you think we did well. What are those things that people can learn from and say, okay, I'm going to take that into my launch? I just made a mental note of that idea of, hey, if you're enjoying this, take a screenshot, share it on Twitter. I think that's brilliant. What else?
Tension. That was the biggest one, man. Before my other launch, I started marketing it 2 weeks before. This one, I started marketing it 4 months before. Every single newsletter, I would make my point in my newsletter, and by the way, this is going to be in my new course. And so the way that I got this from Seth Godin, it's like a rubber band, right? And the longer you pull it, eventually when you do release, it goes a lot stronger. So like 3 weeks before the course, every single day I posted 2 to 3 screenshots of my best slides and I'd explain the point. So, you know, like I might say something like, be clear, not clever, but then the tweet would explain why it's important and then there'd be the natural call to action. So that tension that when I actually came to launch, I didn't really have to push people to persuade. I think the people that were ready to buy were ready to buy. So the tension side, that pre-marketing hype, I think that's really important. I think it's like 80% of the work.
Love that. I've heard something similar from Chris Williamson on this podcast when he's talking about releasing a podcast.
You can build up excitement around something that you're doing as long as the excitement is remotely proportional to what you're going to deliver at the end of it. For the most part, a lot of people, especially people that look to yourself and me and maybe some of the people that are listening that create content, they have this parasocial relationship with you. They're genuinely invested. You are a part of their life. So for me, I've got toward the back end of this year, I'm about to release four of the biggest guests that I've ever done. So I'm going to start to do a teaser campaign now for all four of them individually. And they're all going to overlap and there'll be countdown timers and people will be like wondering who it is. I'm flying out to this place to see who lives in that place. Like, it's just, maybe it's a bit lame, right? And some people might not be into that. But genuinely, I think you need to drag out the anticipation because people want to be invested. Take them along for the journey. This is very much my like club promoter, whatever you want to say, like bias showing through here. But I like doing that. I think that hype generated effectively magnifies your outcomes. And it is a fun way to connect with the audience and to give them something more than simply what you deliver them in terms of content.
That nightclub approach, right? I actually heard the podcast and I used to be the kid that guy was the promoter for, you know, the one trying to get in and stuff. So genius, because he broke his lead magnet, right? He was doing the book one and it like, he couldn't even send that many downloads. So yeah. I'm a huge fan of that approach. What else? So I mentioned about that social proof feedback loop was really good. Volume. So what I realized this time around was like, look, a certain percentage you're going to buy this product. Apart from spending a lot of time on the copy, which I spent a long time diving into direct response world, which is a bit like Vegas, right? It's like there's a lot of money, but you feel a bit sleazy after a few days. The volume of exposure, I wrote a thread every single day. We did a spaces, 18 emails, all those pre-launch emails. I just made sure I was everywhere because then we know at least we're going to convert, you know, 0.5 to 1%. So that was a big help. And that was pretty exhausting, but that's the point, right? It's like game day.
Did George, aka Grammar Hippie, did he help you with the launch of this? I feel like I saw a tweet somewhere in there that you guys collaborated in some way.
So George just helped with affiliating, which is really nice of him. So I actually went and just learned this from a few courses and George has been quite kind to like tell me what I'm doing wrong. And anyway, I sent him an email being like, would you mind affiliating for the launch? And it's quite funny, man, because he asked me how the first day went and I was like, it's not gone as well as I thought. And he was like, well, how many emails have you sent? I was like, three. And he was in George fashion. I won't say the actual thing, but there were some swear words. And it was like, I'm sending more emails for your launch than you are. That's embarrassing. And so from there, it just became a bit of a game of like, he sent maybe four or five emails a day for me. I think he's happy to say, I think he grossed maybe 16K or maybe like 14K, I think. We had like 18K overall for the affiliate. And so that's how we helped out. And it's been quite cool, man, because I set up maybe four or five more people for the affiliate team. Because one thing I noticed in the email copy world, these guys all work together, right? Every launch you hear about it from everyone. But on Twitter, it doesn't really seem to be happening like in the creator network so much. And I said the same to you. I was like, look, if you've got something to sell that's not too similar to mine, I love your stuff. And I mean, there's a really cool way to set up some win-wins around there. So we're affiliating for each other's launches from now on, really.
I feel like it was a very common practice in like the early creator days when the word wasn't even creator. It was just like online marketing. Very, very common. That's actually how I found out about a lot of creators is through their affiliates of this thing. I've never done it very successfully either. I mean, outside of like members of the community can promote the community and that's been impactful for the community itself. But I haven't done like an affiliate launch strategy before. And I don't know if it's something that needs to be relearned and re-embraced by the creator community, or if like the attitude has changed and people aren't as open to that. I'm not entirely sure, but it was very, very common in the earlier internet marketing days. After another short break, I talked to Kieran about what he would do differently if he were relaunching High Impact Writing today. So stick around. We'll be right back. Now, please enjoy the rest of my conversation with Kieran Drew. Well, let's talk about the things that you would do differently if you were to relaunch this course, go back in time and start over again. What would you do differently about launching High Impact Writing?
Sometimes I'm a bit hesitant to answer that question, man, because it's always like cause and effect, right? Where you say you would do something different, but you don't actually know how that would impact later on. So it kind of went as best as I thought it could go. Some stuff that I wish I'd done a bit better would probably be on the building side. I do feel like it could have been more succinct. And that's just time, right? Like the more you trim something, the more concise it's going to be. Actually, man, you know what I would do differently is just give myself a fucking break. Sorry about the language.
Say more.
Like, it's just crazy the amount of pressure you can put on yourself, right? I thought about the launch for ages, but I wasn't actually taking action to do it. The problem is, like, expecting results sort of takes away the enjoyment of it, right? Particularly in the internet world, like, your numbers get so warped, man. Like, when I made like my first 4 or 5K month, I felt like a king. And then it's like only a year later, but you're like, oh my God, if you don't make X amount of money, you're a failure. And so it's a constant reminder to just be like, you know what, cliche as it sounds, enjoy the process. Like, as long as you know you've put in as much work as possible, the outcome is whatever, man. Because at the end of the day, even if it didn't do so well, now you have a reason to work out why, and you go again and you improve. So I'm trying to like bring that attitude to the next thing, where it's look at the positive side of it and just take that growth mindset every time. So maybe just giving yourself a bit of a break. Yeah.
When you think about the future, is the next stage of this to relaunch high impact writing and do it again? Is it creating high impact writing volume 2?
So, and you could probably relate to this a lot, man. It's quite hard to keep your values in mind when this like fame and fortune starts rolling in a bit. And a lot of people reached out, particularly in this direct response world, where they were like, dude, let's go. Cohorts, high tickets, like this is the time, hit 7 figures, whatever. And it got pretty appealing, man. But actually, one thing that I'm a huge fan of is, it's not kind of how much money we can make now, but how much freedom we can build later, right? The leverage game. So I could just keep relaunching this. And I know that that would go very well. I don't like push marketing. I'm much more fond of pull marketing. So we're relaunching in about 3 weeks. Then it goes evergreen. So welcome sequence, because then I know the more I write, the more I earn, even if it takes 2 to 3 years to get that sort of sales that you can do in a year. And what I'm thinking there, mate, is to try gamify it a bit. We're just going to say, okay, let's sell X amount of high impact writing, and how can we achieve that? And the method that I'm leaning towards is to begin to build a kind of product repertoire for the people that are bored, you know, solving specific problems, how to hire a VA, how to write a welcome sequence, whatever I think I'm okay enough to teach. And then using those products as a reason to incentivize other people to buy every couple of months. Because one thing I've said from now on is no more discount selling. So it's actually, I think that's going to take me, 3 to 5 years to build that sort of 8-product high impact writing combo. So aside from that, mate, that's the plan. And then the rest is just focusing on systems. Like, I don't know if you do this too, man, but like you finish one thing and then you dive into the next and you're like, you didn't really smoothen out the system in the first place. And so I'm just trying to go slow and make sure everything is done right as we go through it.
Yeah, I relate to that. There's a book called Hitmakers by Derek Thompson. Have you read that book?
I haven't, no.
I think it's one of the best books that I hear nobody talking about ever, especially in the creator space.
What was it called, mate? Hitmakers by
Hitmakers by Derek Thompson. And it was written in, I believe, 2017. And the idea was, what is the science of popularity? Why are things popular? And it's so well written to talk about why certain things are popular. The book starts with a story of the Impressionist painters, who are the best known Impressionist painters in the world. And the question is, well, how did these, I think, 5 painters get to be known as the Impressionists from that era? And not to spoil the story or anything, but it came down to exposure. Like, they just had more exposure earlier on, which self-perpetuated. And over time, they just became the only ones that mattered.
Exposure to other people, or exposure to the thing?
Yeah, like they were the ones, like when Impressionism came up, they were the people that were talked about, because they were the first Impressionist painters that were placed in a gallery to talk about Impressionist painting. So over time, they just kind of compounded an advantage of, these are the people that come up when you're talking about Impressionism, and that got printed into textbooks. So it's now taught. So, you know, it just perpetuated and perpetuated. But there's a chapter in that book where he talks about the difference between fashion and tradition. And he says, fashion comes and goes cyclically. It gets really hot really fast and then fades out. Tradition is something that is perpetual, ongoing, has no like up and down cycle. And the question I think about a lot with creators today is, we see a lot of fashion creators. Like, we see people that come really quickly and just like blow the doors off and then get kind of stale pretty quickly too. And I've always thought about my own creator business, like, how do I make this so it's not a fashion but it is enduring. It's sustaining. It's different. It's not something that just like peaks really quickly and then fades because there wasn't a whole lot of there, but is a slow build. And maybe that's a story I tell myself to hide from playing bigger and to keep playing small, but it's something that I think about a lot.
It's interesting you say that because it's basically all that's on my mind is the opportunity and cost of your approach, right? And it's funny you say that you're hiding with your thing, but again, I think about your method a lot, where it's like this commitment to quality, which does stop you from churning out, you know, like you're not here writing 2 to 3 threads a week and all that sort of stuff. But I think a lot of people that, for me, like it took me 12 months to hit 1,000 followers. And so there has been that long grind, but now it's this whole, like, you get stuck in one approach when there might be a smarter game to play. And it's maybe along this hitmakers thing. Have you heard of Michael Simmons, the writer?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he has a thing about blockbuster articles, right? And there's a famous post where he's there going, you know what, the long tail, fat head thing, that focus on quality is actually what is the thing that's going to get you the most results long term. But it's kind of hard to do that when everyone else is playing one game. So, you know, you're not really going to stay above the crowd by copying them, right?
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, as I was sharing our business model, I believe, again, that you should build a machine so that the more people come into your world, there's a direct correlation to business growth, we'll call it. It doesn't have to be revenue, but we'll call it business growth. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that machine built, getting in front of everybody that you can get in front of, and that's hyperbole, but getting in front of a ton of people before the machine is ready, I don't think necessarily serves you. Like to me, I would prefer to have some inflection point, giant growth when I feel very confident and have seen evidence that X percent of people who enter this world choose to become a part of this course or this academy or this membership or whatever it is, because otherwise they show up to the party and they're like, what do we do at this party? And you have to be like, well, let me entertain you at this party for a year before I can tell you what to do at this party, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground here, Kieran. I'm trying to think of any other questions I didn't ask that you think I should. Is there anything about the launch that you think we should talk about that we haven't already touched on?
I guess one point that I've echoed to a few people that have asked is when they said, you know, how did you do this six-figure launch? Was it's because I'd done it before, right, with the first product. And people kind of don't appreciate that, where it's like, look, you're looking at a six-figure launch, but you haven't launched the first one. And I remember before I monetized, right, I used to think constantly about how I was going to make money online, how I was going to build my business. And it was quite stressful. And then when you actually look at like the latex of it, it's like you haven't built something to sell. And so what I say to people is like, yes, absolutely. If you're going to build a product, give it your all, like study the copy, study the marketing, build it well. But I'm a huge fan of that whole like prototype approach, right? Like what Jack Butcher says, let's get going, then get good. And then when you come to do the next one, like get it good, then get going. So it's kind of like a full circle thing. So I just say to people, like, don't overthink it, because I decided to take on a writing course, which, by the way, like teaching you how to write, like there's so much stuff. And so I said, it'd be like specific problem, specific person, much clearer defined outcome, which I know you're a fan of, right? Where you need that quantifiable end outcome. And just don't overcomplicate it, right? Because even if you're not a big name, that specificity creates authority. So long as you can be the solution for someone. So mine was for, the original one was for early writers who struggled with writer's block. And I built a swipe file and I gave it a fancy unique mechanism. And we can talk about unique mechanisms as well, actually, if you would like. But just really like build something. And I guarantee when you do the next one in a year, it'll go better.
Yeah, say more about that. What do you mean by unique mechanism?
Sure. So we have like the levels of awareness and market sophistication, right? And what I mean by that is people generally have heard it all before. And so a lot of creators I speak to, they trip up because they're like, oh, I can't find a new problem to solve. And you don't really need a new problem. You just need to offer a new perspective, a way that people can see what you're saying. And so if I was jumping into like AI a year ago, you don't need a unique mechanism. You just need to say, buy my AI stuff. Rob Lennon is a great example of that. He tore it up because he had the authority and he built an AI course. Most of us, however, are in this like level 4 awareness where you've got competition and people need to believe it's going to help them. And a good way to do that is to identify this like unique mechanism where you can say, this is my way of doing it. my like system, for example. So my first product, I called it the looking glass technique. And I'd have a module where I would take tweet from one person, we would extract the message, and then we would apply our unique lens. Swipe file, right? Very pretty way to say this is a swipe file. This one is high impact writing system. And so it's like we frame it as a system. We say it's step one, step two, step three, step four. And by doing that, when people read it, they're like, this sounds pretty cool, as opposed to being like, oh, great, another writing course. So yeah, a unique mechanism, really useful if you want to like make a product stand out a bit, particularly if you don't have that authority or expertise.
Something that I realized you didn't do, or at least I don't think you did in your launch, was to pre-sell the course. Did you consider that?
I did, man. I'll be honest, maybe a little bit of fear. You know, pre-selling is like, what if they don't buy? Which I know is silly, and that's the point. But, you know, yeah, there was that. And also, there was just so much to do. Like, I sort of made the decision early. Sorry, you go.
Well, you basically pre-sold it without giving people a buy button, right? You're talking about how you talked about it for 3 to 4 months ahead of time. So maybe they made the mental decision that they were buying in during the pre-sell period. And that is what helped the anticipation in the end.
Do you think there's, I know it's hard to quantify, but like that opportunity cost then, the people that you pre-sell would have bought it at full price anyway, or vice versa?
Very possibly. For sure. I mean, I think a lot of people come into this and the idea of pre-selling is really smart because it validates an idea and it also de-risks the production time. In your case, it's very possible that you validated this through just talking about it and having it in emails for 3 to 4 months. And as far as de-risking, if you were already earning enough money to live at the time, and you have conviction. This is the thing that I tell people who are like, well, what happens if I pre-sell this and it doesn't hit the threshold that I want? To me, it's a question of conviction. Like, is this the product that you really want to build equity in? And you know your target audience is going to want and enjoy and get something out of? Because a lot of people, they're just early and they haven't built much of an audience. So there aren't going to be a lot of people to purchase it. But if you do know your audience, you understand the people who are already there, and this is something that can and will help them. I think you can invest the time into building something early, but you should just understand the opportunity cost of doing so.
Sure. And I guess actually one thing I did do is beta coaching. So that is kind of a pre-sale, right? So I guess even 6 months before, so September, I launched it as a group coaching program, high ticket, and I sold that before I built it. And that was crazy, man. Like that was 3K ahead. I wrote it on a Google Doc sheet, sent it out to my email list. And I, again, click send. What the hell have I done? No one's going to buy this. And we ended up having to turn away quite a few people. And it was my first 20K month on that one. And it was actually very useful to A, sell then build, because you don't want to disappear for 6 months and no one buy your shit. But secondly, I thought my systems were good until I tried to teach them to people. Like, I was like, oh, this is shit hot. Like, I'm dialed in. And then I taught it to these 6 guys. And then, you know, like 2 months later, I'm like, well, why aren't you doing what I said here? And why aren't you doing this? And a lot of people skip that beta coaching period, right? But you don't really build a good product on paper. You build it with people. So I guess that was kind of my pre-validation phase as well. But it really helped, man, because the coaching was dramatically different to the product. The core stayed in, and it was really, really advantageous to say to them at the end, I just went, yeah, what was the best bit? Like, what 3 things stuck out to you? What was the most confusing part? Like, and I was very honest at the start. I sold it as like, you get this half price, but we're building it together. I'm not there going, oh, this is my first group coaching and I'm terrified, which I was and it was. But I just said, look, the reason why you get this for this price and this much exposure is because you're here to build this with me. And so from day one, I was like, no ego here, tell me how shit I am. And it was really useful because at the end, long list of feedback saying, this was great, this wasn't clear enough. I could see when they hadn't executed on certain things. So I could be like, that's really missed the mark. That's like a me system, not a you system. And so it was quite easy to package that up for the full product.
Yeah, I think doing live teaching, whether it's coaching individually, group coaching, cohort-based course, it's a great step in a product development process for exactly all the reasons you just mentioned. You learn so much about what is resonating, what needs to be more clear, what's missing, And if you don't take that step of testing the curriculum live with other people, you're going to get that same feedback, hopefully. But now you have to reproduce something. And a lot of times you actually don't get that feedback. Actually, there's not a closing of the loop. People just get stuck or they lose faith and they quit going through the material. They don't get an outcome. There's no positive word of mouth. It's like the opposite of a good flywheel.
Yeah. I love the whole flywheel concept. I'm not very good at it, but one thing that I liked was that with the tiered pricing model, your product creates the next problem, right? I find that so fascinating that you know your customer journey and they don't actually. And so what I did for my first product, mate, was the similar thing. It was you buy the product and for an extra $200, you can book a call with me. And I ended up maybe doing 60 one-on-one calls over the year. It was just everything I needed for what was next, what was struggling on, the copy, people just telling you what they need. And so I've done the exact same here, right? It's like you buy this course, there's an upsell if you want help with the next thing. And I'm just going to listen now for 3 to 6 months and be like, well, what is it that they're telling me after the product that I can build? And so that's been quite a cool feedback loop too.
I hope people are hearing that as well, because I've had a lot of success with that in my courses, which is simply adding a second tier of pricing that says, this is the course plus a one-on-one call with me. You can basically mark it up to your hourly rate. And it's been awesome, to your point.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I was trying to move away from is selling my time. But actually, you're kind of getting paid for market research for that, mm-hmm. right? And I do feel like, you know, you mentioned about some creators sort of phasing out. I feel like people lose contact with their audience the bigger they get. And which is, you know, it's understandable. You've got so much leverage. But I'd like to think one over the next few years, one thing I do try to keep up on is just that one-on-one contact with new customers, where you remember what it's like, what they're struggling with. Because I forget now, like that first day posting on Twitter, like it's really hard to remember that feeling. And then I had a call with a guy last week and he was like, I don't get it. I've taken your course and I don't get it. And it's like, oh yeah, because all of these things that you're worried about, you need to kind of empathize that. So I do think it's important that, particularly if you're a content creator, you need to keep in touch, right? Or else you're just talking to yourself and you've lost track of that.
If you enjoyed this conversation with Kieran, you can find him on Twitter at @itskierandrew. You can also visit his website, kierandrew.com, to sign up for his newsletter, Digital Freedom. Links to both of those things, of course, are in the show notes. Big thanks to Kieran for being on the show. Thank you to Nathan Tonhunter for mixing the show. Thank you to Brian Steele for creating our music. And thank you to my sister, Emily Klaus, for creating the artwork for this episode. Thank you for listening to this show. And if you enjoyed it, tweet at me, let me know at Jay Klaus, find me there. Or if you really want to say thank you, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We just crossed 350 reviews on Apple Podcasts. I would love to get to 200 on Spotify. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week.